Good afternoon and welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 73. This is Tom Harris in Chicago, Illinois, where it is a almost warm 40 degrees outside. And I say it's almost warm because it just seems a lot warmer. And like I said last time, the air feels different and the air smells different. And it to me, I think that change has come. Where the last of our substantial snowfall has happened, we are starting to actually see a little bit of difference in the trees as far as like the buds starting to swell. So I have a feeling that winter is essentially over for now. Which is not to say that it's not going to get cold and not to say that we're not going to get more snow, but it just feels different. And it's really kind of hard to put my finger on. And I have a feeling that, you know, the air smells different. I think that has to do with tree sap and that spring is on the way. And, you know, I've not always been right on about my prediction about the last snowfall, but I do think that we have essentially seen the last of winter, at least winter, if you know what I mean. Anyhow, I have a lot to talk about this time, so I'm just going to get right along to it. I have a couple of articles from the newspaper to read. I don't normally do that, and I kind of try to stay away from current events on the show because I don't want people to come back, you know, 3 years from now and hearing me talk about stuff that really doesn't matter anymore, things that have already played out, and so forth. But this is interesting, and I thought I would share it. And this article is from CNN.com, and the title of the article is Liberalism, Atheism, Male Sexual Exclusivity Linked to IQ. Political, religious, and sexual behaviors may be reflections of intelligence, a new study finds. Evolutionary psychologist Satoshi Kanazawa at the London School of Economics and Political Science correlated data on these behaviors from IQ from a large national U.S. sample and found out on average people who identified as liberal and atheist had higher IQs. This applied also to sexual exclusivity in men, but not in women. The findings will be published in the March 2010 issue of Social Psychology Quarterly. The IQ differences, while statistically significant, are not stunning, on the order of 6 to 11 points, and the data should not be used to stereotype or make assumptions about people, experts say. But they show how certain patterns of identifying with particular ideologies develop and how some people's behaviors come to be. The reasoning is that sexual exclusivity, I have a hard time saying that, sexual exclusivity in men, liberalism, and atheism all go against what would be expected given humans' evolutionary past. In other words, none of these traits would have benefited our early human ancestors, but higher intelligence may be associated with them. The adoption of some evolutionarily novel ideas makes some sense in terms of moving the species forward, said George Washington University leadership professor James Bailey, who was not involved in the study. It also makes perfect sense that more intelligent people, people with sort of more intellectual firepower, are likely to be the ones to do that. Bailey also said that these preferences may stem from a desire to show superiority or elitism, which also has to do with IQ. In fact, aligning oneself with unconventional philosophies such as liberalism or atheism may be ways to communicate to everyone that you're pretty smart, he said. The study looked at a large sample from the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, which began with adolescents in grades 7 to 12 in the United States during the 1994-1995 school year. The participants were interviewed as 18 to 28 years old from 2001 to 2002. The study also looked at the General Social Survey, another cross-national data collection source. Kanazawa did not find that higher or lower intelligence predicted sexual exclusivity in women. This makes sense because having one partner has always been advantageous to women, even thousands of years ago, meaning exclusivity is not a new preference. For men, on the other hand, sexual exclusivity goes against the grain evolutionarily. With the goal of spreading genes, early men had multiple mates. Since women had to spend 9 months being pregnant and additional years caring for very young children, it made sense for them to want a steady mate to provide them resources. Religion, the current theory goes, did not help people survive or reproduce necessarily, but goes along the lines of helping people to be paranoid, Kanazawa said. Assuming that, for example, a noise in the distance is a signal of a threat, helped early humans to prepare in case of danger. It helps life to be paranoid because humans are paranoid. They become more religious. They see the hands of God everywhere, Kanazawa said. Participants who said they were atheists had an average IQ of 103 in adolescence, while adults who said they were religious averaged 97, the study found. Atheism allows someone to move forward and speculate on life without any concern for the dogmatic structure of a religion, Bailey said. Historically, anything that's new and different can be seen as a threat in terms of the religious beliefs. Almost all religious systems are about permanence, he noted. The study takes the American view of liberal versus conservative. It defines liberal in terms of concern for genetically non-related people and support for private resources that help those people. It does not look at other factors that play into American political beliefs such as abortion, gun control, and gay rights. Liberals are more likely to be concerned about total strangers. Conservatives are likely to be concerned with people they associate with, he said. Given that human ancestors had a keen interest in the survival of their offspring and nearest kin, the conservative approach, looking out for the people around you first, fits with the evolutionary picture more than liberalism, Kanazawa said. It's unnatural for humans to be concerned about total strangers, he said. The study found that young adults who said that they were very conservative had an average adolescent IQ of 95, whereas those who said they were very liberal averaged 106. It also makes sense that conservatism, as a worldview of keeping things stable, would be a safer approach than venturing towards the unfamiliar, Bailey said. Neither Bailey nor Kanazawa identify themselves as liberal. Bailey is conservative, and Kanazawa is a strong libertarian. Vegetarianism, while not strongly associated with IQ in this study, has been shown to be related to intelligence in previous research, Kanazawa said. This also fits into Bailey's idea that unconventional preferences appeal to people with higher intelligence and can also be a means of showing superiority. None of this means that the human species is evolving towards a future where these traits are the default, Kanazawa said. More intelligent people don't have more children, so moving away from the trajectory is not going to happen, he said. So this is a really, really interesting article, and I know that people are going to take this and completely misinterpret what it's saying. In fact, if you look at the commentary that's been posted underneath the article, which is something I always love to do with stories like this, you'll see that conservative religious people are just going ballistic over this. Now, I think part of the problem here, of course, is that the article doesn't say what they think it's saying. And I think here that this is a really good example of being able to discern from reading of the article of what exactly they are saying. And what they are saying is that liberalism, atheism, and sexual exclusivity in men is actually disadvantageous, speaking from an evolutionary point of view. And it's a very interesting take to put on it. It's not necessarily saying that if you're an atheist or you're a liberal, you're more intelligent. And I think that is the message that's coming across to a lot of the commenters on that thread, which doesn't say much for their reading comprehension skills. But it isn't saying that being a liberal or an atheist is better. And that seems to be the message that some of these people seem to be taking from this. And it's really interesting to read the reactions on here. But it's rather abundantly clear that most of the commenters have taken away entirely the wrong message from the article. And maybe that's the fault of CNN.com for the headline they put on it. I'm really not sure how you would put it any differently. But it's interesting because, you know, half the commenters are saying how, you know, CNN is a liberal network and therefore they want to present this liberal study done by liberal people to try to downgrade conservatism. And that is absolutely not what's going on here. And it's interesting because, you know, this is actually the first study I've seen that's correlated these things to IQ. It's been known for decades that the more educated people are, the less likely they are to believe in God. And the more educated people are, the more likely they are to be liberal. That doesn't mean that every highly educated person is a liberal atheist. Because of course there's a lot of you know, a lot of variation here. Obviously you have conservatives who are atheist and you have liberals who believe in God. So, you know, there's a lot of variation here that is unaccounted for. But of course, the study is speaking in a very general sense. Now they're talking about a statistical difference, and they're talking about 6 to 11 points of IQ difference, which statistically is significant, but it doesn't really mean anything in the real world. You're still talking about a range of IQ that's very much within that average IQ, and that you really can't make any sweeping claims based on this. So I think that really the most interesting part of the story is the reaction that you're seeing in the commentary to the article. And that's, I think, where the discussion actually becomes interesting, because it's highlighting this bizarre overreaction to the scientific issue. And this is something that happens all the time in science. And I've talked about that here on this show in the past, and particularly about evolution and also about climate change. So, this is nothing new, but it is interesting nonetheless. Now, this next bit is probably going to be of particular interest to people who are listening from the States. And I don't mean to discriminate against my listeners who are overseas, because I know that there's a sizable portion of my audience that's not in the USA. However, this is interesting. This is based on an article that appeared in the Washington Post. And I had actually been linked to this over Facebook by a relative of mine who had joined this Facebook group about this organization that just started called the Coffee Party. And a lot of you have heard of the Tea Party movement here in the States. Now, the Tea Party movement is an organization, or it's actually several organizations, and this was started by political activists who, on the conservative side, who kind of wanted to create this anti-taxation type group. And it was the Political Action Committee of Newt Gingrich and a couple other people that got together and created this quote-unquote grassroots movement. Now, obviously, if your organization is being put together by a political action committee, you're not exactly a grassroots movement. You're actually, it's not being started in a natural way by people. But the Tea Party movement has gathered a lot of followers. And, there are a lot of ordinary people who have gotten involved in this as the result of the publicity given. Fox News has been kind of tirelessly promoting this whole Tea Party thing. And the Tea Party rallies are characterized by very vulgar behavior and inflammatory language, racist signs and so forth. This isn't the best group of people, I have to tell you. This is basically rural white people who are anti-government and anti-tax. The T in Tea Party stands for taxed enough already. So these are people who a lot of them are senior citizens who are collecting Medicare and Social Security, but yet they think that universal health care is socialist. So, there's a lot of dissonance here in this, the Tea Party movement. A lot of what they say is against what they actually seem to be promoting. And I guess there's a lot of different opinions about the Tea Party movement. I don't think that everything the Tea Party movement stands for is wrong. And this is why I find this coffee party thing to be very interesting. Now, the Coffee Party is a grassroots movement. This wasn't started by a political action committee or by a politician of any kind. And this seems to be a young woman who is in D.C., her name is Annabelle Park. And the idea of the coffee movement is let me just read their mission statement. Now, this is from their website, which is coffeepartyusa.com. The mission statement of the Coffee Party USA is, "The Coffee Party movement gives voice to Americans who want to see cooperation in government. We recognize that the federal government is not the enemy of the people, but the expression of our collective will, and that we must participate in the democratic process in order to address the challenges that we face as Americans. As voters and grassroots volunteers, we will support leaders who work towards positive solutions and hold accountable those who obstruct them." So this is really interesting, because this is what the Tea Party movement should be and isn't. Whereas the Tea Party is all about inflammatory language and yelling and screaming, the coffee party is dedicated to civil discourse, and they're actually talking about, you know, I've gone ahead and I've joined two Facebook groups based on this, the National Coffee Party Facebook group and also the Chicago Area Coffee Party Facebook group. And one of the things that is a stark difference from the Tea Party is that they are dedicated to civil discourse and rational discussion of ideas as opposed to waving signs and screaming. Now, my concern here is that they may not prove to be very effective because they're not very demonstrative, but we'll see. And I am paying attention to where this is going because I actually like the initial mission statement and what I've read about them so far. I think this is really, really interesting. And this could really turn out to be something really significant. You know, keeping politicians accountable, I'm all for that. And, you know, and I'm even, you know, for protesting something that you don't agree with. But I think the tone that you use is very important. And I think that yelling and screaming and offending people isn't the way to go about things. Now, I've had differences in the past with groups that have had this very forward, aggressive viewpoint. Queer Nation among them. Now, I talked about this in a previous show. You know, back in the 80s, there was this gay rights group called Queer Nation who was all about outing homophobic gay people who were, you know, closeted and would actually go around talking about, you know, homosexuals in a negative way. And this would be people like, you know, Ted Haggard, for example. But, you know, and I take great issue with that because I don't think that it actually does gay people any good to be behaving in that way. And the same goes for the Tea Party. I don't think that the Tea Party movement is good for the conservatives. Now, let's make no mistake here. The Tea Party movement portrays itself as being nonpartisan. But when you're created by conservative political action committee, when 95% of your membership are, you know, from the right wing of the Republican Party, you really can't make this claim of being nonpartisan. But I can completely see the Coffee Party movement as being nonpartisan. They don't actually, in their mission statement, say anything that would lead me to believe that this is a liberal version of the Tea Party movement, which is kind of how they're being dismissed in the political blogs that I've been following in the last couple of days on the conservative side, who are kind of dismissive of this and they think that it's not going to go anywhere. But we'll see. I'm thinking that this could be a very, very interesting thing to follow. And I'm going to continue following the story and reporting back perhaps on this. And I might even go to one of their local, you know, get-togethers if they have this here. Very interested to see where this may lead. This could prove to be far more effective than the Tea Party movement could ever hope to be. And I'm certainly hopeful of that because I really do think that, you know, having civility and cooperation in government is way more important than these sort of hardline positions that are being taken now, and especially by the Republican Party, the party of no, who are sort of just knee-jerk denying, you know, consensus, you know, and refusing to have anything to do with the process and then complaining at how they're being left out. I don't see that as helpful at all. So we'll see what this turns into, and hopefully it'll be something good. Incidentally, if any of you have any feedback or anything to offer on these subjects, feel free to do so. The email address for the show is tom@tomharrisusa.com. I always love hearing from people, and I do have an email here. This came in the last week. This is from our good friend Robert Pels over in Iceland. The email subject line is, "Where's your logic now, old bean?" And in the email, he says, "Behold the power of the supernatural." He links to an article that appeared in the Iceland Review Online, daily news from Iceland. And it is a story that's titled, "Pagan Hex Against Iceland's Enemies Seems Effective." And here you can hear, I'm going to mangle the Icelandic language a little bit here. The story reads, "An act of sorcery against Iceland's enemies undertaken by members of the pagan society Asatruarfélagið in Iceland at the beginning of the economic crisis finally seems to be delivering the desired results, as High Chieftain Hilmar Urm Hilmarsson pointed out in the news yesterday. The Dutch government has collapsed, and British Prime Minister Gordon Brown's political career is hanging by a thread. Members of Ásatrúarfélagið called for the protection of the four Icelandic land whites, the bull, the dragon, the giant, and the eagle, in December of 2008, and performed an act of sorcery against Iceland's enemies, Stoð 2 reports. Now it appears as if their actions are finally delivering the desired results, almost 1.5 years later. Hilmarsson is not surprised about the difficulties Brown is facing, because he is one of those named Iceland's enemy during the pagan ceremony. To follow it through, I and Steindor Andersson sat down and wrote an odhenda, which is a rare form of poetry in the English language, Hilmarsson said. It goes like this. In London town, this lying clown, our land he drowns in chatters. Gordon Brown is going down, his good renown in tatters, Hilmarsson said, adding with a grin, now it seems to be working. Europe has seen unusually harsh weather this winter, and in the UK people are speaking of an Icelandic winter. They feel it is our winter, and that probably has symbolic meaning, Hilmarsson explained. When asked why it took such a long time for the sorcery to work, the High Chieftain replied, people believed in the old days that magic had to go around lakes and such, so maybe the Atlantic Ocean caused the delay, he said, and winked. Now I'm also going to read the follow-up to this, which is actually not a follow-up, it's actually an even older article. This is from even further back in 2008, and this is a little bit about this group, and this is posted on the Icelandic Review on the 4th of December of 2008. Pagan Association honors Iceland's protective spirits. Members of Ásatrúarfélagið, a religious association which honors the Old Norse gods, celebrated Iceland's Sovereignty Day on Monday by honoring the country's protective spirits, the Landvættir, as described in Snorri Sturluson's Heimskringla. According to Heimskringla, the Landvættir thwart a sorcerer disguised as a whale from swimming ashore and thus prevent him from spying on the Icelandic people for the Danish king. During the ceremony, the High Chieftain, Hilmarsson, same gentleman as in the previous article, said that these guardian spirits are still protecting the Icelandic country and nation. The Pagan Association organized Landvættir ceremonies in 5 places in Iceland, Vapnafjörður in the east, Eyjafjörður in the north, Snæfellsnes in the west, and Straumsvík in the south, all places where the sorcerer whale tried to swim ashore, and in Þingvellir, where Iceland's Athengri parliament was founded in 930 AD. During the Straumsvík ceremony, pagan priests of Reykjanes Hauker Haldursson burned a picture of Prime Minister Geir Haarde. The Landvættir, the giant dragon, the eagle, and the bull are depicted in Iceland's coat of arms and on the Icelandic krona. Interesting. Yeah, it's hard to be afraid of a curse that is actually moves so slowly that you can outwalk it. I suppose you do have to stop eventually and maybe the curse will catch up to you. But it certainly seems to me to be the slowest curse ever. I mean, really. Not that I'm afraid of any Icelandic curses, but first of all, why would anybody in Iceland want to curse me anyway? But also, you know, if that happened, not only would the curse take about 3 or 4 years to get here, I'm sure that my good friend Winky Elf and the other members of the ELF, the Elven Liberation Front, would protect me from any such vile curses. And I kind of wonder, you know, about these people in this religious organization going around casting curses on people willy-nilly, that just doesn't seem like a very nice thing to do, does it? Anyway, thank you, Robert, for your email. It's always good to hear from you. And remind me, folks, never to turn into a whale and try to go to Iceland that way, because I obviously would be kept out by the Landsvættir, and I don't want that to happen. Anyhow, I'm just going to finish off the show here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about a question that was raised on the Ross Patzelt radio program over on United Kingdom Radio. And one of the frustrating things, like I've said, about being employed again is not being able to listen to these live shows. And I never remember to send emails. yeah, because I'm at work and I'm doing other things. But Ross actually asked a question about how actors remember their lines. Now, I have a great deal of experience with that myself because I'm a trained actor. I have a bachelor's degree in acting and have done some acting professionally and have done a lot of live theater. Now, I assume that doing live television is not so different from doing live theater. Obviously, you have to be aware of the camera and where they are. That is taken into consideration, of course, during the rehearsal process. But honestly, Ross, remembering lines isn't that bad. And obviously not just anybody can do it, but I do think that most people are capable of remembering lines. As with anything else, the rehearsal is the key to it. And you can teach yourself the words. Now, essentially, when you're doing a play, you end up memorizing the entire scene, not just your own lines, but you're also memorizing the lines of the other actors on stage because you have to be able to listen for cues. And how each actor approaches this is going to be different. So everybody has their own process that works for them. And this would go for something as simple as a voiceover script. And you certainly, Ross, understand voiceover scripts because I've heard you read from voiceover scripts. But also to things, you know, as complex as Shakespeare. You know, obviously, you know, coming up through school, and this is just for your average person who doesn't actually go on to do theater, the concentration is on remembering your lines. And with acting, it's a whole lot more than that because you're not only remembering the words, but you're actually having to be able to convincingly play a scene in the moment to make it seem natural. And that is where you really kind of get away from the sort of grade school acting of, you know, here, you stand here, say your bit, and then you're off. But you have to keep in mind also, Russ, that when you're doing live theater, and it's going to be a little bit different from live television, when you're doing live theater, you have several weeks of performances, and you spend weeks in rehearsal. And it's anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks of rehearsal before a show. When you're actually diligent about learning the words, I mean, that's 4 to 6 weeks is a long time. And when I'm in rehearsals for a show, I'm spending hours with that script every single night. And that's one of the reasons why when I say I'm doing this podcast instead of acting, I really mean that literally. Because if I were actually doing shows all the time, I wouldn't have time to do the show. Because obviously in a professional environment, it's more than just learning all the words. You also have to, you know, put those words into a context that makes sense and be able to communicate them convincingly to an audience performance after performance after performance. And I'm being very oversimplistic here because acting is actually one of those things that you can spend your entire life studying and never be, you know, Laurence Olivier. You know, it isn't simply a matter of an intellectual exercise of memorization and the like. There's actually more to it. And it's one of the reasons why acting is a challenge for me. The intellectual aspect of it, the analytical aspects of it, I have no trouble with. It's the actual performing aspect of it that is the challenge for me. You know, I may be a, you know, trained actor and have a degree in it and have done it professionally, but that doesn't mean that I'm this fantastic actor. In fact, I would say I'm probably the sort of a run-of-the-mill competent actor, and that's one of the reasons why I'm not doing acting professionally. It's why I have to do a day job. And besides that, of course, a lot of the energy that I would put into doing a theatrical production and doing that sort of acting work, I'm putting into this podcast now. So this has become my artistic outlet. And I think I did talk about this a little bit way, way back in episode number one. But anyway, to answer your question in a very brief way, Ross, how do they learn all their lines? Well, they spend hours and hours studying the script. And I suppose that's probably the baseline answer. It takes a lot of work to do it. It's not something that they can just kind of snap their fingers and know the lines automatically. That would be an incredible skill to have, but unfortunately, I don't have it. Anyhow, I'm out of time. Once again, the email address for the show is tom@tomharrisusa.com. From Chicago, Illinois, this is Tom Harris signing off. We'll see you next time.